Before we get into today's podcast, I've got an invitation for you. We're about to kick off the sixth edition of our most popular program, The Neuroscience of Change. This training is based on what revolutionary research in neuroscience has revealed about transformational coaching, essentially showing us what works, what doesn't, and why. In the program, you'll learn what happens in the brain and body when different coaching techniques are used, how to guide your clients into positive learning states that allow genuine change to occur, and why some tried and true coaching methods actually inhibit change and what we can do instead. We created this course because I learned things from the lead teacher, Amanda Blake, that truly revolutionized the way I coach. And every year, she and all the teachers bring in new, cutting-edge science that continues to illuminate the process of transformation. Amanda will be joined by the rest of our world-class faculty of coaches and neuroscientists for this program, including Dan Siegel, Alan Fogel, Claire Dale, David Trelevin, and Richard Boyatzis. It's going to be an amazing, transformative journey. So I hope you'll come and join us. You can head to coachesrising.com/neuroscienceofchange to book your spot. The first class is February 25th, 2025 with Amanda Blake. And if you sign up by February the 7th, you can get the early bird discount. So just go to coachesrising.com/neuroscienceofchange to book your spot. All right, here we go again, another podcast. And Martin, I'm really excited actually about our conversation today. Welcome to the podcast. How are you doing?
Thank you so much, Joel. I'm good. I'm excited for our conversation.
Yeah. So let me introduce you. I'll just say we're going to be exploring today your thinking and your work with leaders. You've written a really cool book called The Unseen Leader, which I really appreciate the message of that book. We're going to explore that as well. So I'll just read your bio out to the listeners and then we'll dive right in. Yeah, so Martin is a speaker, author, and scholar interested in how the past can illuminate today's most pressing leadership challenges. He's a professor at the Lucerne School of Business and a lecturer at the ETH Zurich, and the best-selling author of The Unseen Leader, How History Can Help Us Rethink Leadership. He was born in Sweden. He's lived and worked in Japan, the US, Canada, Mauritius, Germany, and Switzerland. And from 2016 to 20, he was the founding managing director of the Swiss School of Public Governance, where he launched a program for future global public sector leaders. His writing and thought leadership has reached millions of people through pieces in top business magazines such as Forbes. And I was grateful to be a contributor to a couple of really beautiful articles Martin wrote recently for Forbes on leadership. He's also contributed to Big Think, Fast Company, and Minute Hack, and has appeared on well-known management podcasts such as Phrenesis. I hope I got that right.
Phrenesis. Yeah. Phrenesis.
The Leadership Podcast and We Are Human Leaders. He's got a PhD in history from the Maxwell School at Syracuse University and an executive MBA from IE Business School in Spain and a higher education teacher's training from Harvard University and the ETH Zurich. So we're in good hands, Martin. So yeah, I think there's a couple of ways in. We're going to really talk about what leaders really need today. How do we view leadership today? But I'd love to ask you if you could just give us a sense of why you wrote The Unseen Leader. In a sense, like what is it advocating for? Yeah. What's it about?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I'm blushing after that very generous introduction. So thank you, Joel. And how did I come to write this book? Well, as you mentioned in the introduction, my academic background is in history. That was my bachelor's degree, my master's degree, my PhD. I spent a lot of time thinking about the past. And once I started working as an academic, as a lecturer and then professor, I ended up always working in management departments in business schools through these kind of quirks that many of us have in our biographies, not necessarily planned, but actually something I've enjoyed quite a bit. And of course, in business schools, in management departments, the big topic is leadership. Everybody wants to be a good leader. Everybody wants to work on their leadership. And I think that's great, right? That's the one place where a lot of us have a lot of capacity to grow, a lot of room to expand. So I've enjoyed being part of that. But what I noticed very early on as I started working in business schools is that people love to draw insights from historical examples. You know, so a lot of people who write about leadership today will mention, you know, Napoleon or John F. Kennedy or Genghis Khan or all kinds of historical figures to draw some insight as to how we should behave today as leaders. And that's where my historian's brain started clicking into action a bit, because I started noticing that how a lot of these leadership writers were talking about these historical leaders was disconnected from how professional historians write and talk about these historical figures. Right, so that kind of set me in motion. And what is behind this disconnect? Well, if you look at these revolutionary periods in Europe and the Americas, at the end of the 1700s, beginning of 1800s, there's a couple of figures who were very loud, very dominant, leading from the front. And those are usually the people who are, you know, profiled in popular culture and also profiled amongst many leadership writers. But historians actually tend to single out other individuals for having been perhaps much more influential or having overcome much bigger hurdles to then become influential, right? And so in my mind, those are actually the people we should be looking at, these unseen leaders. Because I think today, in a lot of organizations and in society at large, the people who are the loudest, you know, who are shouting the most, who are kind of visibly doing the most, are not necessarily the ones who are contributing the most to, you know, an organization's well-being, to a positive culture, and to ultimately achieving the outcomes that an organization wants to achieve. So that kind of got me started on this journey of writing this book.
Yeah, beautiful. Fascinating. Why do you think there is that discrepancy between the way leadership people write about these historical figures and the way historians do?
I don't know that we can say for sure, but I have a couple of theories. So one is that, we really like adventure stories. You know, we like stories of the hero, you know, a Luke Skywalker or Harry Potter, the person who, you know, kind of has overwhelming odds against them and manages somehow to fight their way through and lead whatever endeavor it is, whether it's, you know, Gryffindor or the rebellion against the Emperor. You know, you manage to lead your team to victory. We like those stories, right? But a good story is, of course, not the same thing as good leadership, right? So that's where I think the first thing we have to do is be intentional about our purpose. You know, if I want to look for a historical character or character today to profile in a book or a movie, I definitely want to go for the most sort of action-oriented type, the person who really faces the most drama and crisis, because that makes for the best story. But often, you know, if we look in organizations today, the people who are always kind of in a crisis situation, they're probably playing some role to contributing to that crisis. And the better leaders might be the ones who are actually circumventing, mitigating crisis left and right, right? And their lives and their tales make for less exciting stories. So don't go for those people if you're trying to write a bestseller or a new Hollywood script. But if you want to learn about effective leadership, those are the people you should be looking at.
Yeah, beautiful. I mean, I appreciate that message from your book. Maybe we could like articulate the different types of leadership that, you know, I'm thinking of Shackleton and
yeah,
people like that. And then, you know, what can we contrast that with actually what are the traits or capacities of leaders who actually were maybe, you know, leading in the way you just described, where they're not even having those crisis moments because their leadership was actually more effective.
Yeah. And I've gotten a lot of flack for, being less than generous to Ernest Shackleton. you just mentioned his name here. So for those listeners who don't know, Ernest Shackleton is probably the most famous polar explorer to have ever lived. He was an Anglo-Irish guy at the turn of the last century, set off four times for the South Pole, for the Antarctic, failed every time. Near-death experiences every time. A few times also some of his crew died. But there's one episode where his ship, the Endurance, was frozen in place and later crushed by the ice, and he and his men managed to trudge and sail their way to safety. It's, again, a fantastic story of resilience, of grit, right? So in that crisis, he did a fabulous job leading. Right, but seeing his track record of four failures, and if we look, I don't want to get into the details, but if you start looking at how he planned for his trips, how he selected his crew, the types of equipment he brought, how he outfitted his ships, sure, he can't, you know, influence the ice, but there were a lot of mistakes he made in how he set himself up for these expeditions, right? But he is immensely famous. I mean, Harvard Business School has numerous leadership case studies that MBA students read about Ernest Shackleton. You know, books about, there are numerous bestsellers about endurance, and Disney Plus and National Geographic just released a new documentary about Ernest Shackleton. I mean, this guy is an iconic figure around leadership. Now, let's contrast that to the Norwegian Roald Amundsen. Norwegians, of course, know him very well, but outside of Norway, it's not a household name the way Shackleton is. This guy ticked off all four of the major polar goals, the North and the South Pole, the Northeast and the Northwest Passage. He was alive around the same time as Shackleton. Every time without much drama. I mean, sure, there was some hairy circumstances, but nobody died. He got the job done with much smaller crews, smaller ships, but just better decision-making, better leadership than these British you know, expeditions that kind of tried to bulldoze their way to wherever they were going. I think that's the guy we should be examining if we want to extract leadership lessons. And so to your second question, you know, what qualities does he have? Well, one thing that you notice with him compared to a lot of the British explorers is just an obsession with his unique context. Right. I think leadership is really context dependent. You have to understand your environment. Right. Of course, leadership is about the people around you, having emotional intelligence, inspiring them, making sure you accommodate their needs. But it's also about understanding, what is my unique challenge? What is it I'm trying to get my team to do? Right. And so you can't just, you know, kind of live your life giving talks in London and then occasionally embarking on a trip to the North or South Pole. Like, you got to do it the way Amundsen lived. He was obsessed with understanding the polar environment, and he dedicated his life to doing that. And in so doing, he was also very unideological. So he uses some technological aids that are state of the art, and he goes back and relies on some Inuit technologies because they quite simply work better than anything else. Right. So just this real willingness to understand the environment that you're in. That's the one. And the other is, if we look at how he actually led and interacted with his crew, this was, you know, a century before anybody talks about authentic leadership, but he embodied that style, right? I think he knew that. So for example, this expedition, the first successful navigating of the Northwest Passage above the, you know, Canadian mainland, which the British had been trying for essentially a century unsuccessfully to navigate, he does in a small converted fishing vessel with a crew of seven, right? But it takes several years. And he knows, you know, this kind of discipline and kind of embodying a leadership persona that's actually not him is not going to work in the long run, because he is living, sleeping, eating with these same people day in and day out. The only way you're going to get them to be at their best is to be authentic, to include them in your decision-making, in your discussions, right? They really function as a family. But of course, at the end of the day, he was in charge, he made the decisions, and nobody questioned that. But if we also read the diaries of his men, you know, they felt taken care of, they felt heard, but they also felt like somebody was taking responsibility above them. British expeditions, now Shackleton is here a bit of an outlier. He wasn't a Navy guy, but a lot of the traditional British expeditions, you know, functioned with naval discipline. That's how they kept their men in check for these long, dark winters frozen into place. That doesn't make happy crew members who want to keep venturing towards the unknown when the ice finally relents, you know, in summer. They always wanted to go back home. So that's the other thing that he did really well.
Yeah, beautiful to hear that. Because some of the themes we've been exploring around leadership and coaching, actually, because, you know, this all is relevant for coaching leaders. But this shift from this view of leadership as, you know, a kind of fixed set of qualities, competencies that are decontextualized, and you know, like we got to emulate those qualities. They're prescriptions rather than generative, ontologically generative. They're prescriptive, and so, you know, actually doing those things is also often more difficult. It sounds easy, but it's more difficult. That view of leadership compared to what I'm hearing you talk about, and I'm curious how this lands what I say, but, you know, leadership is something which is contextualized. So, you know, different leadership styles and decisions arise out of the different contexts. Yes, it's a lot about kind of preparation and reading patterns and adapting to the environment, but also, like, there's this kind of sense of empowering the team and distributed leadership, that it's not something that's, you know, necessarily in one person, but actually is a collective endeavor that, yes, and there's still someone making decisions as well at some point. But, like, it feels like that's, you know, a much more kind of organic style of leadership, which is adapted to complex environments.
Yeah, that totally resonates with my take on leadership too. Many of the things you just said, and what you said here at the end with, let's say, distributed leadership, that's definitely something we see in Amundsen, right? He gave his men responsibility over specific areas of the expedition. He trusted them there, and that functioned really well. And as you also say, it's very context dependent, right? So if we're looking at a giant organization with 10,000 employees, you know, if you're all the way at top, you might have to embody slightly different principles, or slightly different, it might have to foreground different competencies in your leadership development than somebody who's leading a crew of seven, right? And so it is very context dependent. And that's why I think these prescriptions, you know, do these five things and you'll be a good leader, usually fall a bit short, right? And an example there too is, you know, let's just take one thing. I often hear, you know, leaders have to be really good communicators. I think that's true in many circumstances. I don't think it's true in all, right? So take, you know, Amundsen, he was actually a pretty awkward communicator, let's say. His writing's not great compared to a lot of these British guys who put a lot more effort into writing, you know, really captivating memoirs. From what we can gather, when he spoke in front of crowds, is very, very awkward, right? So he's not a master orator. He didn't give inspiring pep talks, say, now we're going to go through the ice, men, follow me. That wasn't his style, but he didn't need to, right? Now, if you're a political leader, you have to rally a country during, let's say, the Corona crisis or something like that, you need to be a master communicator. You can be you can understand the environment better than anybody else. You can be a master strategist. If you can't communicate, you're not going to be effective, right? So it really depends on where you are, what environment you're in. And I think that's probably why coaching is such an important component in leadership development, because part of it is really understanding, you know, in the challenges that I am facing and the challenges that my organization is facing, and with this particular constellation of my team members within this organization that tries to achieve these goals, what do I need to do? What do I need to work on? What am I currently doing that's holding us back or creating friction? What am I already doing that's enabling people to feel empowered to work towards the same goal, et cetera? And that's kind of hard to figure out. And you need some process of reflecting on that. And I think some people do that well by themselves or have colleagues with whom they can do it. Others, that's probably exactly why they need a coach to help them with that.
Yeah. Beautiful. And do you, because just staying with this topic, and we can kind of weave more of the stories out of the book as well. What would you say is like the view of leadership that you hold that, because in one sense, like, do we want to then play the same game as like reducing leadership to, oh, it's not that, it's now this, it's the unseen leader. And it's the, like, how do you hold how we can hold what leadership is? Is it through a set of principles or heuristics, which are more, not kind of reduced, simplistic kind of rules, but more something contextual? Yeah, I think you get my question. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a tough one, right? I don't know that I nor anybody else who spends a lot of time thinking about leadership can deliver one answer to that question, right? Because you're right, we've already talked a bit about how it's difficult to nail leadership down in a few specific transferable principles, right? But on the other end, we don't want to, or at least I don't want to suggest that, we can't know anything for sure. It always depends on the context and you. Because, then why talk about it? So we have to find, let's say, some common ground there. And I think that's what's emerging out of a lot of the research on leadership as well. The way I like to think about leadership development is the following, and it's actually not a historical example. It comes from running. I do a lot of running. It's kind of, what I do to de-stress and make sure that I stay in shape in my 40s here. And there is a ton of great science on running, right? Like from everything from what you should eat, what you should not eat, the kind of training volume, the kind of mix in your training between speed and distance. And, and now that we have these smartwatches too, you can really geek out on this. There's the ideal cadence, the number of foot strikes you should have per minute, and so on and so forth. Right? All of this is out there, the latest science on what is ideal. However, my body is unique to me, as yours is to you, as everybody else is. So the way I see my running development, if you want to, I'm giving this a bit too much weight. I'm not too scientific about my running, but we're drawing the parallel here to leadership. So the way I want to see my running development is that it doesn't make sense for me to experiment with everything myself, because there's already good advice out there, right? So I should, I can read the latest advice on what to eat and not. However, it's kind of my job to try these things out and then see how does this resonate with my unique body. Right? Does eating a banana after the run actually work for me? Yes or no? The fact that it works for lots of other white men out there who are similar to me probably suggests that it's going to work for me, but it might not. And it's my job to kind of figure that out. And that's why one of my favorite running coaches actually has this saying. He says, running is an experiment of one. At the end of the day, it's you. You got to be experimenting on yourself to see how things resonate. And I think that's what leaders need to do as well, right? Maybe you hear a podcast or read a Harvard Business Review article that tells you, don't summarize after other people speak in meetings because, it makes them feel like you're belittling them. Well, then try that in a couple meetings, right? And then see, ask yourself, how does that feel? Get a bit of a feel for how did that sit with the other people in this meeting, and also ask if you trusted people. And if you feel like, okay, this really worked, then that's good. Then build on that. Try it again. Try it a second time. If it doesn't, then abandon it and try something else. It's your experiment of one.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. I love that. I love that. And the running analogy helps. And I think that's what, for me, would invite me into that kind of generative relationship to my own leadership. And, you know, if I was to ask you, like, what do you think are the invitations being made to leaders in these times about the way to lead? Yeah.
And I like the way you phrase that, right? Because they're invitations. They're not, you know, principles that are always true that are necessarily more valuable than others. So yes, the invitations. I would say there's a couple. A big one, I think, that's for good reason getting a lot of attention these days is empathy. Where I think to be effective these days, you not only have to have the emotional intelligence, right, to be aware of how the people around you are feeling and how what you say and do makes them feel, but you also have to really signal an understanding, an appreciation for the human being with whom you're dealing, right? And I think what's really been a positive development in a lot of the, let's say, latest research and writing on empathetic leadership is that, you know, it's not about being nice for the sake of being nice, right? There's a real business case behind this. You can be, you know, even if you're the most diehard capitalist out there looking for profit, it pays to be empathetic because people do better work, right? They're more engaged, they're more motivated. Now, why was that not true 20, 30 years ago when in general, I would say there was less, there's of course outliers, but when, you know, overall there was less emphasis on being empathetic. It was not something that was drilled into leaders. So how did those companies function back then? Well, I would say back then, a lot of the tasks people had to perform within organizations were simpler. Not simple in the sense that they didn't require hard work, but they were kind of easier to conceptually understand, right? And today the world is really complex. And a lot of the challenges now also with AI on top, and then we've got geopolitical tension, we've got you know, social media in the mix, what your company does here is gonna be observed across the world. You've got supply chains that are spread across the world. You've got customers everywhere. It's really complex, right? So the tasks, the kind of projects that teams are working on within organizations, and this doesn't have to be businesses, this can be government or NGOs, it's just way more complex than it used to be. Which means it's a bit harder to, let's say, monitor for a manager, right? You can't see how much work somebody has done in a given day because it's a bit nebulous. You notice only at the end, you know, did these 10 people, my team, did we together manage to solve this problem and move ourselves one step forward? Yes or no. But, you know, it's not like on a day-to-day basis, you can look over somebody's shoulders and count the number of, I don't know, numbers they entered into their Excel sheet, which was true to some extent 30 years ago. So because this has changed, you know, if you want your organization to be successful, you need the people working for and with you to feel engaged, right? To feel valued, to feel like they share a purpose with you. And that requires, you know, empathy, that requires a relational style of leadership and not this transactional, you know, get this done now and then tomorrow get this thing done and I'm going to look over your shoulder while you do it. That doesn't work anymore.
That's really insightful. And I was going to ask you just mentioned relational leadership. That, I mean, do you think that the empathy is becoming important because the complexity is meaning that we need to leverage that kind of distributed leadership phenomena, which I think is probably, it's always been the case, you know, that we just viewed leadership as being something different. But do you think that's that's happening because of the complexity that yeah, I mean that's what you're saying. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, there's a link there, right? Now, is it happening solely because of that? I don't know. It's possible, but I think I certainly don't feel like I have a grasp on, why it's developed exactly the way it has. The other thing I would throw in there is, what's also changed vis-a-vis, I'd say a few decades ago, is that people bring more stress to work. Right, we see this in lots of surveys that people are very uncertain about the world, right? And we mentioned geopolitical tensions, and then there's the threat of AI taking away people's livelihoods. There's with if you have kids and teenagers, with social media and lots of other things, those are major concerns that a lot of, let's say, middle-aged professionals have. And surveys show people bring this stress with them to work. And so I think that's another, maybe not a cause, but another reason for why empathetic leadership is important, that we understand that while to us people show up to work, and showing up to work, many of us work from home now, but so it's maybe not even the right saying here, but while in the minds of the manager, I'll say when people are working they should be focused on work, that's not necessarily always true. And I think that's something we should be aware of, and also be respectful of, that life is pretty uncertain for many people. That is stressful, and signaling that we are aware of that, are respectful of that, I think can diffuse a little bit of that stress, at least in the workplace.
Just to reflect on that's one of the things I see in my work with my clients a lot, is supporting them to respond to the reactivity and stress that they face in their lives. Because if, and it sounds really obvious, but if someone is feeling reactive, stressed out, triggered by a situation, that's going to change their biology, the chemicals in their biology, the way they think, the way they feel and connect, and it reduces that connectivity and the ability to collaborate and to think expansively. So, I just find that is one of the fundamental skills we're being invited to develop, to manage our state, really, to be able to sh to shift to manage our state, which is intrinsically about acknowledging where we are and including what's arising for us. It's not about trying to push that away to get back to a place where I feel good again.
Yeah, that's really nicely put. I think you're right. The wish that many of us probably have to be able to just push it away is not realistic, right? It's about living with it and managing it in some way. This reminded me of what you just said, reminded me of the Forbes article that you mentioned during the intro, where, in case the readers are not familiar with this, it was a piece in Forbes where I asked half a dozen coaches from around the world, to tell me about the challenges that the leaders they work with most often report to them. What is it the leaders, people who are in charge of other people at work, who kind of have a complex role within an organization, what challenges do they want to work with you on? And all of you, without discussing this with each other, and all of you have different backgrounds, coach, kind of a different, let's say, have different focus. You all came back and said, the leaders we work with are overwhelmed, right? It's too much. I don't see that fundamentally changing. It's more of a matter. It's more a matter of living with and in that, right?
Yeah.
No, maybe you mentioned at the article at the beginning, maybe you got some insights from that experience of, you know, I only spoke with you and the other coaches individually, and then put it together into this piece. I don't know how that resonated with you or what you recall from that.
Yeah, no, absolutely, absolutely. It doesn't surprise me in a way, because, you know, I think it's not even just leaders, but, you know, everybody's feeling that. And for me, it's two-sided. On the one hand, there is an invitation for me personally as well, speaking personally, to look at the way that I react to all the different moments in my life. And it's a mirror, you know, it's a mirror into my own development, as you named yeah. earlier. On the other hand, for example, I've heard coaches speak about, yeah, you don't want to just support clients, executives to kind of survive within toxic environments, you know, because the system itself is actually under pressure and, adapting and misaligned in many ways. I think, you know, we can see that there's this tension. So there's both.
Totally.
There.
Totally. And I think that's a challenging question, right? Like if you as an individual, whether you are in a leadership function or not, if you are in a toxic, or it doesn't even have to be toxic, just like an unhealthy environment, you know, we could say, well, you are part of that system, so you have a responsibility to fix it. That's the one line of thought, right? And the other is you need to get out of there because the system's bigger than you and it's going to grind you down. But if all the good people leave, then that system is going to continue the way it was before. And that's actually a question I work with a lot of leaders from big organizations. I'm not a coach, though. It's more usually on a mentorship or a consulting basis. But I do often get this question, you know, you write about these unseen leaders who get overlooked, who actually do a lot of good work, but get overlooked. Meanwhile, there's some guy over here who's just, you know, kind of doing lots of stuff. Everybody loves that guy, even though he's not really contributing towards the successful outcome of things. What should I do? And I don't know the answer. I mean, part of me says, get out of that organization and find a place where what you do and you as a person are valued. But the other part of me says, well, you got to stay and you got to change the system. You got to change the culture, right? Because if you don't do that, who's going to do it? Somebody's got to start. So that's a tension for sure.
Yeah. Beautifully spoken. And one that, you know, is unique to each individual, ultimately, which way that might fall. Let me make sure we close some loops. You said that there was like two issues for you around leadership that are alive. Like one was empathy. And have we named the second one? Is that people are stressed, or was there a second one beyond that?
Yes, you're right. One is, you know, empathy. A lot of writers and leadership commentators are for good reason emphasizing empathy. And I think the other one, which I would say my book, The Unseen Leader, is a part of, a small part of a larger movement, which is to kind of reframe or to think about leadership differently. Put differently, you know, we should look for different leadership qualities. We should celebrate different types of leaders within our organizations. And here, there's lots of really interesting studies from organizational psychologists that I also lean on in my writing and my teaching and my speaking. And I could go into any number of studies here, but one of my favorites is Neil McLaren from the University of Binghamton in the U.S. found in a lot of different experiments he ran that whoever spoke the most in a meeting was considered to have the most leadership potential by others after the fact, regardless of what the person say, right? So, and often these are men, you know, who are just repeating things that women or other people said. After the fact, everybody's like, that's the guy, he's the leader, right? So we need to change. We need to reimagine what it looks like to be a good leader. And of course, there's lots of studies also to suggest that if you're a white man, you're already, you know, considered to have more leadership mettle, or you look more like what people expect a leader to look like. So there too, you know, we need to be more diverse in the types of leaders we look for. Because I think the danger is in organizations is that it becomes, you know, this reinforcing cycle, this self-fulfilling prophecy, that if you believe that a good leader is a white man who speaks a lot, who is very loud, that's who you're going to promote. And suddenly everybody else only sees those types of leaders in the organization. And they will start to see that as the, you know, key characteristics of leaders. And people will start being loud and speaking a lot because they figure that's what I need to do to make my way to the top. And obviously that's not very good in the long run for an organization. So reimagining leadership is something I'm passionate about. I know you've talked about that a lot on previous episodes as well. So this is a movement, you know, that many of us are a part of.
Yeah, beautiful. I mean, we've been doing that already. What might we begin to value in terms of, you know, instead of someone who speaks the most, for example, what are some of those things that actually are part of this distributed leadership phenomena that make a difference?
Well, I think the challenge is that right now, kind of in popular culture, in traditional organizations, we judge leadership and leadership potential by largely irrelevant, but very easily observable characteristics. Not easily observable. By that, I mean, you know, people who do a lot, people who are perpetually busy are seen, lots of studies confirm this, as having more leadership mettle than others. People who speak the most are seen as having more leadership potential than others. Even people who are taller, you know, perceived more as leaders, right? So these are easily observable characteristics, and that's probably why we've sort of gravitated towards these things. And I think the challenge is that to really pick out, kind of identify people who are having, say, a positive influence on group norms. A lot of research now is into group norms, that high-functioning teams, they have norms, kind of traditions and ways in which they interact with each other that set them apart from teams that don't perform as well. Now, figuring out who is contributing to creating and maintaining positive norms is something you can do, but it takes a lot more effort than just kind of keeping track of who's talking the most. You know? And so that's the challenge, right? I think to reimagine leadership, to be a bit more nuanced about it, requires paying more attention, taking more time, speaking to more people, and observing. Right? There's no shortcut to this. And an interesting example here, I think, out of sports is, you know, the Chicago Bulls, who in the 1990s were, I mean, many people considered the best sports team ever across any sport, right? They just completely dominated at a time when there were lots of really, really good teams in the American National Basketball Association. And if you ask most people, including myself as a kid, like, why is that? They would say, it's because they had Michael Jordan, right? The ultimate high performer, you know, a scoring average, a steal average, all of its average, they're incredible. Like this guy, you know, there were a couple of years where he was scoring on average half the points of the team on any given night. Like this guy's incredible, right? But if you look a bit more, and so long story short, I mean, it helps to have a Michael Jordan, right? That's not a bad thing. You know, he's driven, he kind of motivates other people to perform at their highest level as well. It's definitely not bad to have a Michael Jordan, but you don't want to just promote and look for the Michael Jordan types. And what I think the key to the Bulls' success, if we really look into them, is that their coach, Phil Jackson, he appointed, in the season that they started winning, a co-captain with Michael Jordan, this guy Bill Cartwright, who was by this point a pretty bad basketball player, right? And as a matter of fact, Michael Jordan often gave him a really hard time for missing shots and kind of being slow, and he had knee problems. So why would Coach Phil Jackson promote Bill Cartwright's co-captain. And bear in mind, most teams don't have co-captains. They have one guy, and it's the best guy. It's the Michael Jordan, right? Why would he do that? Well, because Bill Cartwright was one of these guys who built and put effort into creating healthy group norms. And I think Phil Jackson, the coach, had noticed it wasn't Michael Jordan. It was Bill who talked to the younger players. It was Bill, when you missed a shot, he was the guy who would come over and kind of tell you, it's all right, you'll get it next time. You know, keep your head up. Right? He had an intuitive and an authentic way of building these healthy group norms that enabled this team to be so successful. Right? Now, you can't build a winning team with just a bunch of Bill Cartwrights, but you can't build it with a bunch of Michael Jordans either. Ideally, you'd have a bunch of people who embody both, you know, characteristics, but that's a bit hard. But I think that's the thing, right? We got to stop just looking for the Jordans. We got to look for these Bill Cartwrights there too.
Yeah, and what I like about this example is makes me think about the systems. And when you say group norms, you know, this idea of like, what are the practices and interactions that we have inside of the group that produce a certain behavior. So, you know, then you start to look at, because like, I think another element I haven't spoken to is like, we atomize leaders, you know, it's like as if they kind of exist outside of the system. And then they're like, you know, from outside, like influencing the system. And that idea has been challenged by people like Dave Snowden and many other people. But so this, what I'm hearing in your example is that, yeah, it's actually about the relationships again. Like there's a co-captain, so that's creating a certain kind of interaction, and you know, there's an innovation in the kind of group norm there that produces certain behaviors. So there's like a system at play as well, and that seems really important.
Totally, and your listeners, I was smiling and nodding vigorously as you were talking. The listeners won't be able to see this, but you showed very nicely with your hands how, yeah, we sometimes imagine the leader as, yeah, being atomized, standing, and you showed this with your hands very nicely, standing apart from the group and kind of influencing the group from afar. But yeah, that's not how it should be ideally, right? Because you're a part of this group and this system that you're in, and you need to see yourself as such. I think what really comes to mind here as well, as we're talking about this, is the work of Amy Edmondson and others who talk about psychological safety, right? That in part of healthy group norms, that is, you know, how people interact with each other, is that teams that perform well generally have a strong element of psychological safety, meaning that within that group, people feel like they can give, but that they can also receive feedback, that they can make mistakes, and that those mistakes will be learned from and not, you know, necessarily punished from the get-go. You know, even before Amy Edmondson kind of popularized this concept, there was this great study on Google, I think it was from 2010 or so, where they looked at hundreds of teams in Google. And, you know, Google's then as now is just packed with the best people, right, in terms of skill set, right? They were all the best programmers, the best project managers, et cetera. But some teams totally outperformed others by all the metrics that they had and that they, you know, valued at Google. So what was the difference? Well, it was these group norms and this psychological safety. In some teams, they, for some reason, dependent on the people who were there and how they worked together, how they related to each other, were just able to establish healthier ways of working together. And they outperformed everybody else.
Mm. Yeah, that's super inspiring to hear, because it also feels real. What I mean by that is, you know, if you think about, I remember watching a TV show about Shackleton, and I remember being gobsmacked by the story. So I was like one of those people, really, that was like, holy moly, like the adversity that they overcame was something else. But yeah, you know, actually hearing that actually he was likely very culpable for getting them in that situation in the first place. That was not named in that documentary at all. You know, it's like, so there's a blind spot there. And I'm wondering if there are like other, yeah, the real thing. So it, because it, that heroic leader kind of notion that can create this sense of like, I need to be special. You know, only the special few have those qualities that can save the day, you know, whereas actually it starts to feel like something much more kind of manageable, and that we each have our role to play inside of leadership, you know, like, yeah, that just feels great.
I totally agree. And maybe to circle back to the running analogy, you know, anybody can run a marathon, right? But nobody can, or very few people can kind of just get off the couch and do it, right? What it takes is the willingness to work really hard at it. And I think that's the same in leadership, right? Like it's something you have to work at, right? Relating to people, developing emotional intelligence, that's not easy. I think some of us maybe are born with you know, a larger innate ability than others, but leadership is something you have to work at, just like running. Yeah, the heroic types, there was a great study that came out of Harvard just this past summer that showed that randomly assigned managers on average outperformed those in groups who really wanted to be in charge.
That's interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, it's super interesting. And why, right? So I mean, I'm speculating here because this is not evident from that particular study. I mean, I think it has to do with overconfidence, right? The people who have always wanted to be leader, always seen themselves as the guy or the woman who should be in charge, are perhaps a bit more prone to overconfidence, you know, and confidence, I think, is important, right? If you really don't believe in yourself and you question everything you do and you're always worried about what other people are going to think, that's not a good way to lead. You know, that's going to, you're handicapping yourself. But on the other hand, there's lots of research that shows that a little bit of imposter syndrome, a little bit of anxiety, actually leads to better leadership outcomes, right? So to make this concrete, there's a researcher in the US named Basima Tafiq, and she did the study with medical students. And she noticed that medical students with imposter syndrome, you know, who kind of felt like, do I really have what it takes to be a doctor? They actually performed no worse in diagnosing patients correctly, right? So let's say the technical aspect of being a doctor, they were on par with the doctors who had no imposter syndrome, or the aspiring doctors who had no imposter syndrome whatsoever. However, the medical students with imposter syndrome scored much higher by patients on things like empathy, patient care, communication, all of these dimensions, right? So being a little, you know, lacking a little confidence, or occasionally feeling like, oh, did I do that right? I think that's healthy because it keeps us developing. It keeps us soliciting feedback, and it fuels this willingness to work on yourself, which if you're overconfident, you're like, I've got this, I'm just going to go from the front and people are going to follow me. That's not a very reflective way to go about leading people, or life for that matter.
That is, to me, a really powerful reframe of the imposter syndrome, you know, the importance of humility, reframing confidence, because that is, like you said, that is a trait that, you know, I want to be confident, you know, like, and of course, like you say, there's a good thing to developing a healthy sense of self-worth and, you know, feeling good about who you are and having an innate sense of value. And yet, like what you name there is really powerful for me. It's like, no, it's actually about the quality of your you know, your openness, you know, that little bit of doubt is actually what has you attune to your environment, the people around you, and check, you know, and sense in. And that's that relationality that we've been speaking about in action again, rather than just like, yeah, you're projecting your beliefs about what should happen on, which, you know, just, and again, I want to hear what you think about this, which is the same issue I have with, you know, some visioning and goal setting that can be done by management teams, where it's like that is brought down and then imposed upon the organization, rather than, you know, like, let's like tune in and really feel from everybody what's wanting to emerge, you know? And
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think it's also, you mentioned humility, which I think is spot on. It's also about being aware of the fact that, you know, in some cases, you yourself might not be the person who has the best, you know, knowledge or toolkit to address the problem, right? Like, in many cases, maybe yes, but in other cases, you know, maybe it's somebody else, and you got to defer to them, and that takes humility. We're totally aligned on this. Adam Grant, another, you know, organizational psychologist and management thinker, I follow very closely. He talks very often about this idea that good leadership or good leaders find a healthy balance between confidence and humility, right? That too far on either end is not good. You got to find the sweet spot.
A word you named as well, management. And I liked your TEDx talk because there was a phrase you used, which was from someone else, like, boring management matters. I think that's important to weave in here, that we often kind of separate leadership and management out. But how do you see that? Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, that's a great question. So the phrase boring management is Rafaela Sadoun's, who teaches at Harvard Business School, just to give credit where credit is due. I think conceptually, thinking about leadership and management as two separate, I don't want to say competencies, but let's say buckets, makes sense in the classroom. And this doesn't have to be a classroom per se, but any area where we're kind of trying to analyze an organization or ourselves, right? And management there in that thinking is more about creating structures where there is chaos, right? So a big organization has to create a budget. They have to have some kind of financial planning. You can't just go, you know, kind of freestyle into the next year and spend money where you want and see how things go, right? And you have some organizational chart, whether it's flat or very hierarchical. You have somewhere some kind of planning about who does what and who reports to whom, etc. That's the management side of work, right? And the leadership side is the relational, right? In inspiring people, checking in with people, the non-tangible sides, let's say. So John Cotter has this very clean definition of the two. He says, you know, management is about dealing with complexity. Leadership is about dealing with change. Okay? And I think that's a decent way to think about it. But again, this works well in the abstract, right? But then once you're actually looking at yourself in work, the two are very often blended together, right? There's like very few challenges I can think of that are purely leadership or purely management, right? Most challenges we have to deal with, can require a little bit of both in both areas, let's say, right? So there's not this clean break, I think, in real life. And so this phrase, boring management, that Rafaela Sadoun introduced a couple years ago, is part of this broader movement that we've already mentioned now a few times of reimagining leadership, of reimagining who are the people out there who are actually doing the most good work. And what she has found, she's looked at a lot of really big organizations, you know, like healthcare providers and et cetera, financial institutions. There's this problem we've talked about many times that the people who are celebrated and promoted are often the people who are very visible in their leadership style. They're loud, they give lots of pep talks, etc. When in fact, she documents, you know, the performance of the organization can largely or very often significantly be attributed to things people are doing on the management side, the boring things, you know, like making sure the budget is done properly and that it's changed as external circumstances change, you know, that it's aligned with the environment. The stuff that nobody really celebrates, that people only notice when it goes wrong. Right. So it's the same thing we've been talking about. I think that we need to reimagine what good leaders look like, what the work that goes into or the work that good leaders do that make them effective. It's not this cowboy stuff. And I think this has to be said at some point. Maybe this is the place to say it. I don't mean to suggest, and I don't think other people who speak and write on this topic mean to suggest, that it's never appropriate to lead loudly and boisterously from the front. You know, like if an airplane is you know, in a nosedive, like that's not the time to like sit down and do the boring management stuff, to be like, okay, you know, do we need to re-examine system X, Y? Like, you got to do something, you know, you got to get people into action. You got to shout orders. It's also not the time to check in with how people are feeling. Like, you need things done or we're going to hit the ground. Right. So sure, that's when that is called for, but that's a very specific scenario. You shouldn't behave like that every day, right? Because the airplane is not crashing every day. And what we've also seen, I think, is that in organizations where people learn that the leaders who get, or not even just leaders, the people who get the most attention are the ones who avert a crisis, what then happens is that even when there's not a crisis, people start talking about what happened yesterday and the projects they're working on as if it is a crisis. So another leadership scholar, Keith Grint, he makes this point that people learn to reframe everything as a crisis because you notice that's what I got to do to get people to notice me. If you just, you know, deliver on time, under budget, no drama, you don't have a dramatic story to tell about it, you might really be the person who is holding your organization to the highest standard, making the most with what you have. But if people aren't noticing you, you're pretty quickly going to learn to talk about, you know, how dramatic the project you managed was in the future, or you're not going to get promoted.
Yeah, that's a good point. I was going to say, you know, on the one hand, it would be great if we lived in a world that acknowledges what really matters, your management, a contextual leadership style, this understated kind of style of leadership that we've been pointing to. And on the other hand, you know, people live in a world that values these things. So, you know, if you're a coach supporting a leader and they want to be promoted, you know, then there's playing the game, isn't there? And it, you know, it also makes me think about the global situation, you know, and that this idea of crisis, you know, I've been thinking about that, and it feels like everything is a crisis now. And if you look at news organizations that need to get advertising revenue from having attention, and then like everything is a crisis, and you know, what does that do to our nervous systems? And you know, we talked about leaders being stressed, and then you know, the noise is just getting turned up, you know. And so I often think about what are the deep beliefs and like the way our society is ontologically designed in order to kind of take us down a certain path. It would be, yeah, it could be great to actually change some of those beliefs and kind of lower the volume a little bit. And, you know, imagine if we got away through these crises we face with boring management. You know, that's not what people like to say, is it?
No, it's not. It's not. Well, I think you mentioned the word nuance a couple times, and I think that's really a key word that's emerging from our conversation here. And why do I say that now? Well, because there are some real crises in the world. You know, I'm sitting here in southern Germany. There is a war a few hundred kilometers away, a vicious, brutal war of aggression that is not imagined. That's there, you know, and that has implications for most aspects of life, even more so, obviously, if you live there. But even here, you know, in southern Germany, it is a presence. And that's not an imagined crisis. That is there, right? So, but it's the nuance, I think, that's required is then not seeing, you know, or learning not to see crisis everywhere, right? Where sometimes there really isn't one, or where there's perhaps a healthier way to reframe something and look at how the world interacts. Because there's also a lot of beautiful things and positive things about the direction our world is taking, and I think you need to acknowledge and celebrate that as well.
Yeah, beautiful. Yeah. Thanks for for nuancing that. Because yeah, it's not to say there are no crises, but it's like the mentality of crises being applied, like it's the glasses we look through everywhere. Yeah, just like as we come, you know, as we're heading towards the end of our conversation, I'd love to ask you, you know, in a sense, like this whole conversation has been an invitation for coaches listening to consider what they bring to the executives and leaders they work with. But, you know, you're working in business schools, you're working with leaders. And so you're listening to leaders and in touch with what they need as well. And I'm curious, what would you say to the coaches listening about the invitation being made to coaches in these times on how they can best support leaders? And I think this whole conversation has been that, but I'm wondering if it brings anything else up.
That's a great question. Maybe I'll preface it by saying that I know a lot of coaches very well. My wife is a coach, has been for a long time. And I have a lot of respect for the craft that coaches bring to their profession. And therefore, I don't know that I'm in a position to, you know, give any advice to coaches because I think it's easy. I think it's easy. And I hear this, you know, on LinkedIn and elsewhere, like, oh, coaching is fun and it's easy. You should try it. Right. But I don't think that's true. Right. It sounds like a really, really hard, intense thing to do, but like leadership, right? Where there's lots of best practices out there, but you got to see how they work with you and your style. You have to develop that over the years, always being self-reflective. So I don't want to barge in here and give any kind of advice, or at least I first want to preface it with saying, I acknowledge the challenge for me as an outsider to give any kind of tips. Maybe one thing I'll say that's helped me is, you know, sort of two values that I try to live by is to be humble and to be curious in my work. You know, I interact with a lot of students, I interact with a lot of leaders. I get to see the inner workings of a lot of companies. And it's easy to get in a position where you feel like, all right, I know what's going on here. You know, and sometimes I do because I've seen the same exact thing in 9 other companies. And now I can tell the 10th one, hey, look, I think your problem is this, right? But I have to stay humble and curious because maybe that's not the case. Maybe it just looks like it, right? So I need to be curious enough and humble enough to say, let me see what these people really, what is their lived experience? And then, you know, draw my conclusions. And I think that's the danger with any of these professions where coaching or kind of teaching, where you're doing the same thing over and over again, and you develop this rich repository of experience that you can draw on. And that's really valuable, right? But you can't get lazy about it and, you know, kind of just jump to conclusions. So I suppose that's my tip based on my own failures and successes as a professor and speaker and writer on leadership and the world of work.
Yeah, I really appreciate that. It's a real danger, isn't it? You know, we start to layer our kind of assessment of what's happening onto this unique emergent situation and individual, and then doing so lose touch with what's actually being invited. And you know, I think that's actually pointing to like a major why you said, you know, coaching's hard. It is, like, if you want to be masterful at it, and that's one of the practices, you know, is like, how can I actually have a healthy relationship with my knowledge? Because you know, the danger is that knowledge is applied in all kinds of situations where it's, you know, not quite appropriate or fitting. And I think it's actually maybe one of the leadership lessons that's been imbued in the whole conversation today, that curiosity and humility. And what's at the edge of what's inspiring you around leadership right now? You know, like, I imagine, I preface that question with, I imagine you're someone who's just really inspired and curious, you know, as you just named. Like, where are you being drawn? Where's your excitement being drawn in terms of what's emerging in the field?
I mean, I try to read and listen more broadly than the specific subjects I teach and deal with on a day-to-day basis. So I still read a lot of, you know, classical history books. I listen to podcasts about mountaineering and psychology and economics and all kinds of stuff. So, you know, if you're asking me what's interesting me right now, I could go in all kinds of different directions. But let me try to feel free to actually.
You know, like I've been getting a lot from reading Andreas Weber, like the German philosopher, biologist. You know, and yeah. So I really love getting inspiration outside of the field.
No, I think it's healthy, right? It's something we should all be doing. I think it's a trap to think, you know, to be a better coach or to be a better leadership, scholar or whatever the case is, I should just read the things that are within this field. I think that's a mistake. One thing that that just came up the other day is, I'm not on a lot of social media. The only network I'm on is LinkedIn. And then I try to post with some regularity, just because there are some people who are interested in my work and I'm interested in a lot of other people's work. So I try to stay a little bit engaged, but I try not to obsess over it too much. And now at the end of the year, I'm trying to post a lot about things I learned this year or new people I met who've inspired me or new podcasts that I didn't know about before, et cetera. So a lot of these kind of year in review posts. And yesterday I was sitting down to write one about what have I learned about, you know, kind of personal well-being and productivity, and who have I learned the most from? And three names came to mind. And when you post on LinkedIn, you know, you got to link the people, right? And remember, this is personal productivity and well-being. Two of those three people are not on LinkedIn or on any other social media network.
There you go.
I'm like, okay, this tells me a lot about why these two of the three, I mean, the third person also accomplishes this and is on social media, but why they are so insanely productive, producing super high quality stuff and seem to be really happy and healthy in their lives. So that was a self-reflecting moment that I had just yesterday.
Yeah, beautiful. Yeah. Yeah, I feel the real pull to create, you know, like a good amount of time for myself next year each morning to write and think and, you know, be in an inspirational space. I'm trying to think of the Hollywood director, he's English, who won the Oscar for the movie about, like, I can't remember the name, the movie about the atomic bomb and the quantum physicists. Do you remember, there was a big movie from this year. Do you remember what it's called?
Was that this year? Are you referring to Oppenheimer?
Yeah, Oppenheimer.
Last year, yeah.
Who directed Oppenheimer?
No, what I remember is that it came out at the same time as Barbie. So there was Barbenheimer.
Chris Nolan.
Right.
Yeah.
Chris Nolan. Yeah, of course. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. What I learned was he doesn't even have no smartphone. I think he has like an old phone and never gives his number out. So you're just
brilliant.
Uncontactable, basically.
Yeah.
Not online at all. And that's what allows him to be in that space of creativity. So, yeah, just a little vignette to share there. I was like, oh, that's pretty radical in this day and age.
Yes, totally. I think it might not be something that all of us need to embody, but if you have a craft that requires a lot of long chunks of concentrated work, I think social media and smartphones and all that stuff is probably not doing you any favors.
And Cal Newport's slow productivity, you know, I think he, in a way, it's got some similarities about, he's like busting some of the myths of what people who created extraordinary things, how they lived their lives. You know, it took decades for them to birth their work, and they took extended periods out from doing anything, you know. And,
He was one of the three people I mentioned I wrote a post about, and then I didn't even try to link him because I know he's not on LinkedIn or anywhere else, but yeah, great thinker. I love his stuff.
Hey, Martin, this has been fascinating. I really appreciate having you on the call, and just all the perspectives you've shared, and the kind of deep thinking and exploration you've done around this. And so I'm delighted. Yeah. So please come back again. I'm sure we can do a part two.
It was great talking with you, Joel. I learned a lot as well. And yeah, let's do it again.
And where can we find out more about your work?
Yeah. Well, as I mentioned, I am on LinkedIn occasionally. So that's a good place. And my website is Martin Guttmann, GUTMANN.com. Happy to connect with anyone.
Thanks, Martin. Thanks for listening to the podcast. I really hope you enjoyed it. And a reminder that the early bird enrollment is now open for our upcoming live training, The Neuroscience of Change. This program reveals the biology of change, showing us what happens in the brain and the body when different coaching techniques are used. You'll learn how to work with the innate pathways of change in all of us, so you can create powerful transformation with your clients. Just go to coachesrising.com/neuroscienceofchange to book your spot. And remember, you can get the early bird discount if you join by February the 7th. Here we are. We're at the end of the podcast. Just a heads up again, if you're not on our mailing list and you want to stay in the loop about other things we create, then head to coachesrising.com, put your name in the sign up box there. You'll also find some of our other offerings, our online trainings for coaches there. And just want to end by wishing you well, and I'll see you again next time.